What I would like to do with this workshop session is I definitely want to make it interactive, and although it's being recorded for distribution to whoever orders it, maybe I'll try to repeat some of the important comments you have into the microphone here. But has anybody come with a case or case example of patient that they'd like to discuss? I think I'd like to do some other things first, but I hope somebody's maybe got a patient that they took care of once that they wondered about or had some questions about. Nobody's got any? Maybe.
Oh.
Well, no, I was just asking whether anybody, either the physicians or perhaps yourself as a pastor, had case examples of where ethical dilemmas over patient care came up that you'd like to for us to discuss here.
Yeah,
we can do that. Okay. Well, let me give you some time to think about that and sort of kick off with some things myself, including a patient or two. And if possible, I'd like to use the time to share with you the usefulness of the model that I described earlier today, at least the usefulness that it has had for me in trying just to make sure that I've covered all the bases in figuring out what's going on in a situation. It doesn't always necessarily give us an absolutely clear answer, but I think it's an excellent tool for helping us make sure that we haven't left any major considerations out, and for helping us integrate a particular case. First, let me just go over the various questions that each of these corners of the triangle, the normative, the situational, and the existential corners, generate. Because that's the first thing. One of the major aspects, I think, of coming to any good ethical conclusion is to make sure we're asking the right questions. And often, if we don't have clarity regarding what the questions are, then we certainly won't have clarity regarding what the answers are. But in general, it's top of the triangle related to the normative issues. We're going to be asking, what does the law say? What does God say have to say about these things? In the lower left corner, we're going to be asking, what is the situation? What exactly is going on? And in the lower right corner, the existential corner, we'll be asking, what's motivating people in this situation? What's motivating me and what's motivating other people? More specifically, obviously, for the normative side, we're asking, what do the scriptures say about the particular issues at hand? And we don't have any time to go into it in detail, but certainly the kinds of things that Dr. Davis was giving us just now are very important for us to understand. Things like, is sin ever the immediate cause of a particular illness? And if so, is it always the immediate cause of a particular illness? Well, the answer to the first question was yes. The answer to the second question is no. And that's clearly biblical. That sometimes we're given the opportunity to understand why a particular thing has occurred to a person. Sometimes the linkages can be more direct, such as, for instance, drunkenness while driving results in trauma. Well, that's pretty obvious and certainly is a direct consequence of that sin of drunkenness. However, on the other hand, it's probably much more common that we don't understand the direct linkage. It's much more indirect than that, between sin and sickness. Even though we might say, I think it would be biblical to say that ultimately sin is the cause of all illness. It's the ultimate cause of all illness, but it's not the proximate cause or the immediate cause of all illness. And so that means a lot for the way we need to relate to people who are sick. We need to understand the context, the environment perhaps within which they got sick, and the fact that it involves fallenness and brokenness. But on the other hand, we're never, even when we do know that there's a direct link, such as between drunkenness and trauma, we're not given the prerogative by God to pass judgment on the person. We, particularly as healthcare practitioners, are called upon to care for the person, and that means a lot more than just healing their body. That means addressing the problem of the drunkenness and so on. But other things, other normative things that I think would be, that are definitely biblical and that apply directly to medical ethics that we ought to keep in mind as we approach our difficult problems, would include the sovereignty of God, the fact that God is always involved in every situation we find ourselves in, the uniqueness of man. This is something which, of course, is very contemporary and very important with the animal rights movement, both elevating the care of animals and demoting the care that humans are given, or at least arguing for that. The right to life, the fact that life is given by God and it's not our prerogative to be directly involved in the taking of life, at least as medical people. There are instances which I think many Christians would agree with, such as just war and capital punishment and all, but those are, we don't think we ought to bring those up. There's not total agreement on that. But at least it's definitely, I think we would all have to agree that God is the one who has the prerogative over matters of life and death. Another one I think that's interesting, and some of this begins to get into my own particular interest, which is issues at the end of life, treatment decisions at the end of life. I've got the fourth in my little series of articles in the yellow journal, the orange journal that some of you are carrying around. It's going to come out in a week or two, and it's on the application of this model to treatment decisions at the end of life. And one that I think is really helpful, a biblical principle, comes out of Hebrews chapter 2, and that is that we should not be enslaved by fear of death. On the one hand, God has given us our life, and on the other hand, and part of that also is in the book of Romans, I think it's Romans 14, 7 and 8, he says that whether we live or die, we belong to the Lord. It is the Lord's prerogative both to give life and to take life. But then in Hebrews 2, he tells us that Jesus is our example. And by being his people, we should not be enslaved by fear of death. That's something that he has freed us from. So there's a biblical norm related to, I think, the treatment decisions at the end of life. Comment. Go ahead. Getting pretty young, isn't it?
Let's say I'm 45. 46. But anyway, when they're talking about a potential major surgical expense that will probably wipe out all of the family resources if you pull in the sons and daughters to help pay for it, I'm thinking of a case where the question was several years ago, a cancer patient, and then the person had developed some heart trouble, and the issue became whether to implant a defibrillator, and this was probably doing it then was more expensive then than now, maybe because of the worst stage of development of the defibrillator is. And the patient felt terrible receiving that, but the children, three children, were insisting on it, this is my parent, and what else can I do?
Yeah.
But be willing to, and two of the children had children themselves, and think, well, these financial resources would they have been better used? And did the parent, should the parent have been listened to? How sincere was the parent in saying, I don't want to attend? Do I just blindly obey the doctor? And the children, should the children have been more bold to say, okay, parents, if you don't want that, then we won't press for.
Yeah. Well, that's just the sort of question that turns me on, actually, because I think that's...
Okay.
That's fine. That's fine. For those who are going to be listening to the tape, the question relates to we'll call it a hypothetical cancer patient who might be in maybe a 65-year-old person with cancer who develops a heart problem for which a pacemaker might be a defibrillator. Okay. More serious heart condition, which might result in sudden death without a defibrillator, and the patient is uncertain about how much he or she desires to have it, particularly in light of the cost involved, but the family, the children are desiring to go ahead with it, want the parent to have it in spite of the known cost, which might be considerable enough to break the back of the finances of the family, even for a long time. Well, I think that this is the kind of case that Christians are often very reluctant to really delve into and really jump into, because I think we often fear that if we even begin talking about it among families, between doctors and family, and so on, that we will immediately be encroaching on the commandment not to kill. At least that's one fear that I seem to notice in people, fear of talking about it because of the possibility that we might be committing murder. But let me first say that, as I understand it, the commandment, thou shalt not kill or thou shalt not murder, and other prohibitions like that in Scripture really don't apply very well, probably, to this situation in which it's not something that we would do that we kill the patient generally, although that's another thing that Hilton didn't mention in his lecture. There are all too many times when our therapies are directly involved in killing a person. Hopefully this defibrillator and the surgery involved in putting it in wouldn't kill the person. But nevertheless, I think in general we're not in the domain of, we're hardly entering into a possibility of breaking the biblical commandment against killing in making this decision. So the fear over that, I think, first needs to be reduced. And maybe we need to go back to these principles, the norms which might apply to this particular situation. One of them would be certainly the right to life, the respect for life. The fact that this is an elderly person doesn't make any difference. The fact that this is a person with cancer doesn't make any difference. The fact that, I mean, in terms of whether they would be a rightful recipient of whatever medical care we had available, at least those factors, I think, don't remove from them the right to life or whatever. Did you have a comment?
I was just going to ask you, it would not make any difference to you if they had a terminal cancer.
Well, that's another issue. We'll get onto that as we get into the other triangle of situational. The fact that they have cancer, I think, is a very important aspect of it. Okay, another thing that, assuming that this person is a believer, in any case, if they're not a believer, it's fairly direct what we ought to do in terms of evangelism and counseling and so on. But if they're a believer, then we need to reassure them about the fact that they don't need to be enslaved by fear of death. And was a believer, okay. Is still, okay, had a good outcome, at least for the short term. Well, then we need to examine the situational considerations here, and the questions that are to be asked of the situation are, number one, what is the patient's condition? Well, you've mentioned that the patient has cancer. We'd need to ask more questions about that.
Cancer at that time was in full remission.
Full remission, okay. Well, that's very important. If she had known metastatic disease for which there was no further treatment, and so on, then that might change things. That wouldn't necessarily make us say, oh no, you shouldn't get this defibrillator, but that goes into the whole equation. Do you know what kind?
That I don't know. Something that was responded to the treatment that was chemo,
okay.
and radiation.
Probably some surgery and chemotherapy.
But they had told the patient that
Of long-term cure, in fact, or just of palliation, significant palliation. Okay. Well, that the kind of cancer, the general prognosis of that, if there really was a good chance of cure as opposed to simply palliation for a couple of years, then that might change things as well. Then another issue, then, in terms of the situation, is what treatments are available in the future for the cancer itself. And another is, what are the risks and benefits of putting this defibrillator in? How well known is it to be effective? Is it likely to, I would think there's probably certainly a less than 90% probability that this defibrillator will be effective in really cutting off this heart condition, really intervening. I don't know enough about implantable defibrillators to know, but there's certainly something involved there. Sometimes we get into talking about chemotherapy when there's a 10% chance of a partial remission from a particular chemotherapy, and then the side effects of chemotherapy are pretty significant, and yet we often find ourselves going ahead and giving these treatments because we feel like we've got to do something. Well, those questions would need to be asked. And I think that we are very afraid, maybe especially as Christians, we may be more afraid to even bring up the issue of the costs of therapy, of this particular therapy, than we might be if we were non-Christians. Because again, I think we really fear muddying the question of life and death issues with questions about cost. And nobody really likes to talk about those things, but in the situational. We're still in this is in the situational corner of the triangle. The cost would be one factor to enter into an understanding of the situation.
The majority of the world isn't even a possibility.
Yeah, yeah. Geography is certainly another one of those situational things. If you were in the middle of the bush in Rwanda or something like that, then the defibrillator would not be an issue at all. That's an interesting side issue in itself, actually. But I think it's probably safe to say that we're basically, of course, responsible to make decisions on the basis of what we have here and now. But that's a more global issue then, is whether we, in the cases of particular patients like this, ought to be bringing in those more global cost issues. I think it's probably not generally appropriate, but in other contexts. None that I know of. There might be some nephrologists listening. Yeah, very expensive.
We couldn't do that.
Yeah.
We're sorry. Your
uncle's going
to die.
Yeah.
We're approaching a time in our society where we're not going to be able to afford that.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to be able to afford it. But every kidney failure patient on dialysis, those decisions are real tough.
Yeah.
When you can do something, how do you turn your back on it and say, we're not going to do
I don't know whether it's a cop-out on my part or not, but I tend to think that if decisions like that are going to be made, resource allocation, resource restriction issues, that I feel fairly comfortable in saying that they shouldn't be made at a particular patient's bedside, although sometimes, if your experience is the same as mine, they're brought up at a patient's bedside to say, well, this is really too expensive a therapy to use for this patient, and I think that may be a bit of subterfuge when that happens. We may really not want to treat this patient for some other reason, but we happen to bring in a resource issue which is totally out of our control and which we have no real responsibility for right then, I think, in light of that particular patient. But those, I think, would probably have to be discussed in more removed and larger, even legislative bodies. I'm not sure. Will? Can we put that off just a minute? Do not resuscitate orders. He wanted to talk about do not resuscitate orders, and that would be relevant to this patient certainly, especially depending on the decision we make about the defibrillator and maybe about future cancer therapy too. So anyway, all those things do need to go into the equation, whether we like it or not. The cost issue is there, and we may make a concerted decision not to admit the cost issue as a decisive factor, but it's definitely there. And I don't know if you have the sense yet, but I think that often by the time we've looked at Well, often by the time we've looked at normative issues and situational issues, the thing is pretty well taken care of. But then often that's not true. I think in this case, it doesn't really take care of the issue. We're not finished with it by any means. Sometimes there's, in fact, not much of an ethical dilemma when you really analyze the situation and you really lay out the prognosis. It often is fairly clear. But then I think if we go on to the third point of the triangle, the existential motivational one, then we ask questions like, what does the patient want first? What does the family want? And then the second questions are, why do they want it? And I think that is often the crucial factor that really makes a difference in whether we ought to feel good about a particular decision that we make or not. And it gets very complicated, and often people don't tell us what they think, and often we don't admit to ourselves what we think and why we want to do it. But I think we might ask the patient on the one hand, is this a therapy that you really do want, and you're feeling guilty about it only because of the resources that it's going to require? On the other hand, we might ask the family, are you only wanting this therapy for your loved one because of the guilt that you figure that you will assume if you don't provide it for her? And this is where pastoral counseling and physician counseling and I think needs really to be applied to these situations to make sure that people aren't dealing with all of this out of a framework of guilt. If they're making decisions on the basis of guilt now, then they're probably not going to be happy with them later on. Now let me create one scenario which I think might be one of the easiest to deal with, and that would be one in which yes, Peter.
Can I just make a general perspective to comment on the way that John framed it, that I think is helpful here, because the way you're describing this particular scenario, it seems like the norm is getting lost at the end of the decision making process.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's not your intent, but that's impression I'm getting. And what Frame does in his discussion of these issues is to show how each of the perspectives actually involves the others.
Yeah.
If you look at the perspectives properly, then it actually includes these other considerations.
Yeah.
For example, you can take any one of these perspectives, and that can be the whole perspective.
Right. Yes, that's right.
We have 10 commandments, but we also have capable.
Yes. Yeah.
There are situational factors actually in there, and we can discern how the principles are worked out in particular situations, and we can apply to the same model of thinking. Obviously, the Bible doesn't deal with specific modern issues, but we can see how the principles are applied to specific situations in the Bible itself.
Yeah.
You can take the normative, the situational perspective, and do the same thing. Because one of the elements of our situation is God's word. We have God's word. That's part of our situation. So that's factored.
Yeah,
because
sure.
Of any of these,
that's exactly right.
And it will include the others if you look at it properly.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's exactly my intent by discussing these three, not to be leaving the others behind, but to be making sure that we're sort of hanging on to everything we've got in each one until we've sort of built a whole picture. So all of this needs to be held on to. Well, let me put sort of a twist into this scenario to sort of make one possibility out of it. Let's say that the woman is in despair over her cancer. She really is very depressed over the fact that she has cancer. And now she simply says, I've got this heart condition that's been added on top of this now. What next? You know, and then she might say, I don't want this therapy, simply because what's the point? And I'm going to die, and I'm going to curse God and die. Let's forget it, and let's be done with it. Well, I think our approach to her might be very different if she says that, versus, on the other hand, if she says, I've lived a full life, I've walked with the Lord, this number of years. I have a family which is trying to make it on its own, and a family of hardworking people who are hanging together. And it appears that I don't have much longer to live. In any case, let's say the prognosis is for gradual deterioration over the next few years. And this therapy, as it is right now in 1980, whatever it was, is so expensive that it would, for that one therapy alone, it would strap six members of my family financially for two decades, three decades. I really don't think that's a responsible use of my or my family's resources, and I think that as a family unit, I'd like to get them together and discuss this with them and present to them the possibility that I would not take this therapy, especially given its potential side effects in itself, its potential lack of real efficacy, and its huge cost. And if necessary, I would rather forego it for the larger benefit of my family. But that's a very different scenario from the first one, where she's saying, forget it, I don't want this, you know, I'm angry, I've got cancer, I can't deal with it, and all. And I think both of those, as you suggest, Peter, are very much presented in Scripture as different case examples. There are cases of people who wanted to commit suicide and did commit suicide in Scripture, and basically always did it for the wrong motives. On the other hand, there are cases, the supreme case being Jesus himself, who gave up his life for others and said in John 15:13, the greater love has no man than this, that he should give up his life for his friend. And so I think we could, understanding that, of course, the norms don't change in these two different scenarios. They're exactly the same. And in fact, the situation in terms of the prognosis, the cost of therapy, the expected efficacy of therapy, and on, may be no different in these two cases. But the crucial difference is the motives. Just exactly what are the motives. In the one, it's more perhaps a despairing tending towards suicide. Not really, but at least tending more in that direction. On the other, it's a much more selfless a possibility of self-sacrifice, that I'd rather do this for the benefit of others. And I think that the scriptural judgment regarding it is very different, that on the one hand it might be considered actually commendable, on the other hand it would be considered unwise, perhaps even culpable, I'm not sure.
So actually we're talking about, in the existential section there, regarding the proper motives, we have a norm that we get from Scripture, and it happens to be an existential or a motivational norm that God is telling us, love for other people, love for God, love for other people, can be one of the highest motives that you can express in a situation like this. And it may, in fact, express itself in the sacrifice of yourself. Now, usually John 15:13, greater love has no man than this, that he should lay aside his life for his friend, it's applied in our lives from time to time on a, you know, a non-lethal kind of way. We would lay aside our interests for those of others. But certainly that's a norm which tells us that this motive is one perhaps which not only which is allowable, but which is commendable. Now, the way I presented those two, they seem to be fairly clear-cut, and most cases aren't exactly that clear-cut. This case is going to be somewhat more complicated, because these people may not be fully aware of what their motives are. And if the patient herself doesn't step forward and say, okay, I'm going to take this upon myself, I'd like to forego this therapy for the benefit of my family, then you have a very different situation. And I think if we ever were to step in and say, Mrs. So-and-so, I think you ought to forego this therapy for your family, we'd have to be awfully, awfully careful about doing that. And we'd have to know the patient very well, and so on. And we shouldn't be putting motives into her mind, probably, in that sort of way. But maybe to lay out these things for her and for the family would be helpful.
Yes.
I would have a hard time offering therapy or encouraging the therapy that I myself do not want, even if her heart condition, this patient's heart condition is so bad that they might have ventricular fibrillation at any time and die suddenly, versus maybe having 2 years likely to live from cancer or 6 months or whatever time period you want to stay. But you have no way of knowing when they're going to have fibrillation. And if I had cancer and had the option of possibly dying suddenly from ventricular fibrillation or having a prolonged death from cancer, I'd say I don't want to.
Don't want the defibrillator for that reason. I think that's certainly a very important thing to enter in if the patient really isn't in remission, or if the remission that she's in is likely not to be prolonged. Then that really does, I think, help a great deal in potentially even removing this from an ethical dilemma or an ethical situation, and simply make it. In fact, I don't know where you cross the line between a difficult treatment decision and one which really has ethical and moral implications. Maybe that again comes back to motive. When we start getting our motives all mixed up in this, and we start thinking of ourselves and not thinking of others, then it becomes a moral issue, perhaps. But definitely, I think it would reduce the pressure to do this kind of therapy if her cancer were not in remission.
It seems that there's another normative issue, and that is, what do the children? This patient tended to be compliant, but I could tell the patient had opinions, but just tended to be a pretty compliant person, and maybe not able to do a tremendous amount of analytical thinking of all these factors, and depended heavily on the children.
Mm.
Especially the two sons, and of course the patient's husband,
that's all right. We've been making her to be a female for a good while now.
Already died, but that has been dead. But so there's a question of the biblical norm of how children show love to their parents, and maybe even also how does it appear to the non-Christian community, or what are you fostering? Will it be understandable enough to the Christian? Just back off and say we're not going
to
do it.
To consider foregoing therapy, yeah. Well, I think again, for the tape, the question Ken raises now is related to, well, I guess one thing that you're saying is what effect will this have on others, both inside and outside. I think it's interesting to speculate on that. You could imagine some ill effects that it might have due to misunderstanding, but on the other hand, you could imagine the possibility of some very profound effects on other people when they see Christians really giving themselves for each other and really putting aside considerations for themselves and thinking of other people, putting others over themselves, which is, after all, what we're supposed to do in general as Christians, not demand our own rights, but consider the others better than ourselves. And maybe it could be an illustration of an application that the world is normally cynical about because they don't see it in Christians. I think the other issue you raised too, Ken, though, of the patient and the family not perhaps having the intellectual capacity to really take this apart with you and walk with you every step of the way, that's a very common one, and perhaps more common than not, and that doubles the challenge. I can't say that I have a lot of personal experience with it to comment on that, but I'm glad you're raising all this as a pastor, because I think it's really obvious that this is not simply and shouldn't be simply a doctor-patient kind of thing. And I think the physician needs to see himself or herself as a counselor as much as possible, and also, of course, to recognize the power that the doctor has to sway the argument one way or another by the way they present the risks and the benefits of the defibrillator. You could walk in all of us who are physicians, I think, would agree that we've probably all done it at times. We've walked into a patient's room with the idea in mind that we were going to talk them out of this therapy, even though it was available, because it didn't appeal to us a whole lot, or for some other reason. So we have a great deal of power, I think, which we have to wield very carefully. But then the role of the pastor in all this, I think, in bringing the pastor into this decision, is something that hasn't maybe been used enough, hasn't been developed enough. Okay, other situational factors. Are they believers? Are they not? Are the children dependent on her? Are they not? And so on. Yeah. Okay.
I'd like to hear your attitude, maybe in a general way, about patients at the end of their life. And I can certainly list lots of little case histories here, if you like, of elderly people that I've taken care of and trying to make decisions about when to intervene. Should I intervene, even if we can? Okay, how about a 75-year-old gentleman that's had Alzheimer's disease and has spent the last 5 years in a nursing home and has a cystostomy tube in his bladder, a gastrostomy tube in his stomach, and he comes in bursts from
the fever.
Septic and has pneumonia.
Yeah.
Family's upset, one of your partners, because they think that according to the sitters, the family is out of state, they don't ever see the patient. Sitters are complaining of possible negligence on the part of the doctor, your partner, and so they want something done. You're having to worry about lawyers, and so what do you do?
Yeah, there are all kinds of other people that enter into situations, aren't there? There are families who may have been very attentive. There are families who may have neglected the patient. We've all probably seen families come along just when the patient was in extremis and demand that something be done, where, on the other hand, they hadn't seen the patient themselves for a year, or perhaps they came by for a cursory once a month or once every other month visit just out of guilt, but now they want you to pull out all the stops and do everything. I think these get in, obviously, again, to, tremendously into motivational kinds of things. Why are people wanting to do what they're doing and so forth? And that's why it helps me anyway to realize that this is an important part of it and something that we don't just have to decide about, is the antibiotic going to be effective and so on. But we need to understand these other issues. There's the issue of a family that wants to occasionally the family that wants not to give any therapy that may well be effective and prolong a person's life a good deal longer because they see their inheritance being eaten up. And that happens for real. Again, you've probably all been in situations where people are trying to get wills signed in the intensive care unit and even getting wills changed and that sort of thing. Families are not always motivated by love for the particular individual that's there. I didn't address your particular...
that scenario where you've got something such as an antibody for infection, and you've got that general condition, and you made a decision as a clinician to say, I'm not going to give you antibody.
Yes, I think so. And not being in primary care practice myself, I probably wouldn't, I know I would not have been approached with that situation nearly as many times as you had. But I think it's a decision that everybody in primary care practice makes one way or another, whether they admit that they make the decision or not. And may I recommend to you a book along these lines by Dr. David Hilfiker. Maybe some of you have read it, seen it. I wish I could remember the name of it. A wonderful, very honest man who lives now and works in Washington, D.C. He's a family practitioner. He's a believer, a Catholic, and is involved in a healthcare ministry to the poor. And I first came across him in an article that he wrote in the March 24, 1983 issue of the New England Journal of Medicine. In fact, in my article that I basically did my lecture on here, I go through and used as an example through the whole analysis, a case that he describes that's very much along these lines. And he was very honest in saying, I make decisions like this for or against antibiotics for little elderly people who've been in a fetal position in a nursing home for years. I make these decisions all the time. And he brings in the fact, this case, in fact, I think is a wonderful one, and he also has it as a chapter in his book, 69-year-old woman in just that sort of instance, and he gets awakened at 3 o'clock in the morning by the nurse in the nursing home saying that she's got a fever of 102. And he goes through the whole process, and this is where the motivational existential thing comes to roost on us. He starts saying, okay, I really don't want to get out of bed right now. I really don't want to treat this patient right now for this particular illness because I'm asleep and this is moving in on my territory. Okay, so we have to deal with that one. Then as he gets to the nursing home, he points out the fact that it's Ginger who's on that night. She's a nurse who's taking care of Mrs. Toivonen, and Ginger doesn't like heroics. So he knows that if he's going to be pretty aggressive and treat Mrs. Toivonen, he's got to fight Ginger over it, okay? Well, that's another part of the situation, right? And also the motivations. Why is she motivated against heroics? And why, and then in fact, would he be potentially withholding treatment from this patient only to maintain good relations with Ginger for future, because he's got to interact with her again in the future. And these things get so complicated. But one thing that he does point out that I think is very worthwhile is that regardless of how altruistic and idealistic we might be about giving every patient everything we've got, we all make decisions about how much is too much therapy and how much is enough. And he does it very simply by saying, would you do a cardiac transplant in this lady if that's what she needed? Probably not. Would you do a coronary artery bypass on her if you knew that she had 90% left main disease or something like that? Would you do angioplasty on her? And she's been there for 4 years in a fetal position, totally aphasic, strokes on both sides, can't move a thing. Well, you probably wouldn't do coronary angioplasty. Well, then he says, okay, well, let's just move on down the line and let's come to a point where we find something that you would do for her. Probably at the bottom, most anybody would say, we should give her nursing care, we should turn her in the bed, and we should offer her food and water. Some people would begin arguing over immediately when we start talking about putting an NG tube in and feeding her that way. But he says most of us would gravitate up toward a level where we might either give her IV fluids and an antibiotic there in the nursing home, and possibly we might transfer her to the hospital and give her IV fluids and antibiotics there. A lot of people would fall somewhere between those lines. Others might say, she's really been here all this time, and as a matter of fact, they remember, she really didn't like doctors a whole lot. She avoided coming to them at all costs when she could avoid it, and now she can't. Maybe that would be a justification for simply giving her an oral antibiotic and oral fluids and hoping for the best, knowing that they're unlikely to be of benefit. So we all definitely make decisions along those lines, and we draw a line somewhere. And it's not a matter of whether we draw a line or not, it's only a matter of where we draw the line and why we draw the line. And that, I think, is as important as anything else. Why are we drawing this line, where we're drawing it?
It just seems to me that you got to draw the line if you really believe you're benefiting that patient.
Mm-hmm. Well, but then you have to be sure that you're defining benefit, how you're defining benefit, too, because you might actually argue that at this point it would benefit her to go on, especially, let's say, if you know that she's a believer. Would it really be a net benefit to her? Philippians 1, Paul says, to die is gain. So even in the best interest, this also comes back to what I said during my talk about the fact that we as Christians ought to be comfortable with coming to different conclusions about these cases. Because on the one hand, person A might emphasize the fact that Paul says to die is gain. On the other hand, you might emphasize the fact that something else, that this therapy might be effective, might give her another couple of years of life or something.
But in most cases, you don't have any idea if the patient's a believer or not.
Yeah, you often don't.
You realistically think you're going to resuscitate and witness to
her? Good question, especially in this. Yeah, well, that of course argues very strongly for having relationships with your patients and not this hit and miss medical care that the Americans have gotten into, doc in the box style and so on, where you don't know each other and also I think brings in, without getting into a prolonged discussion of living wills and other such things, brings up a point about what's the best way to express your desires regarding treatment choices when the end of your life comes. And I think from what I've read and considered and people that I've talked to, there's no substitute, and there probably never will be any substitute, for communication both with your doctor and with your family, assuming that they will be there when you're unable to express your wishes at that point. And if they know you well and know what your attitudes are and so on, that'll help them out a lot. And it'll help us as physicians out a whole lot if we know our patients and even ask them questions pretty directly about that, especially maybe when they get admitted to the hospital.
What about a terminal cancer patient with metastatic cancer of the kidney to the bone, severe pain, now comatose, on large doses of morphine, and has reached a point where they won't need to make the decision to not treat them, and then die?
And to go on further, now for the tape, the next patient is one, and maybe we need to get to your DNR question here too, Will. 75-year-old patient with metastatic renal carcinoma and a great deal of pain, who was not able to eat at some point, or not able to take in enough food or water, and would die fairly quickly of dehydration. Even before starvation per se. Well, that raises a very, very sticky kind of question. And there's been something of a hue and cry against the American Medical Association and other groups that have made statements allowing for that, for withdrawal or withholding of tube feeding in situations such as that. To be honest with you, I don't really share the abhorrence, the categorical abhorrence of that possibility that a lot of other people do. I think that's probably more because of the complexity of these situations and not wanting to rule out, again, the possibility that a person out of a sense of self-sacrifice might want to do that, that there could be very different reasons that they would want to do it. And that we shouldn't preempt their decision necessarily. There's always the option, of course, of a person being given whatever food and water they could take. And this is what hospices are all about. And here's another situational issue, which is very difficult to deal with. If you end up in a hospice, as opposed to an acute care hospital, the decisions may be very different because hospice is directed toward the terminal care of patients, and to my knowledge, hospices don't put down NG tubes when people can't eat and drink enough, and yet lots of people in hospices die of dehydration because they're not able to take in enough. So does it make all that much difference that the patient is under our care in an acute care hospital? And I have a hard time saying yes to that question. Perhaps we ought to be more willing in an acute care hospital to work through this kind of question with a patient and not force an NG tube down them, particularly if they seem to be saying no. The hospice people will teach us, I think, that dying of dehydration, at least from the observer's viewpoint, doesn't appear to be an excruciatingly painful kind of thing. The sensorium becomes clouded and so on at a fairly early stage in dehydration, and there are worse ways to go, they say, at least from what you can observe in that. Doug Guthrie. Yes.
And see, the next argument, if we're going to do something to kill somebody in a few days, why not just give them a lethal injection to get it over with?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the real danger of not giving them.
That's exactly right. It sure is. And it raises the question of is tube feeding more like normal eating or is it more like a medical therapy? And maybe you all know what the courts have said about that for what it's worth. They've said almost universally that it's more like medical therapy than it is like normal food and drink. And we might differ with that. I guess I try to straddle the fence on that. but definitely those issues do come into play there. Not to finish this before we deal with Will's question about do not resuscitate orders, I guess they fall in general into the same kind of consideration and analysis. Understanding, again, these various factors, respect for life, the fact that God gives this, it's not our prerogative to take it away, but that doesn't necessarily help. If a patient's going to die right now, are we taking away his life by not resuscitating him, or allowing God to take it by not resuscitating him? That's as much an attitudinal kind, motivational kind of thing as it is, a circumstance or an external thing. And so, again, we need to understand and go through this whole issue of prognosis. If the patient survives the acute resuscitation, what is their prognosis after that? Do they have another underlying illness which will take their life in a short period of time? What is their attitude? What is their family's attitude? Do we know whether they're a believer or not? Is there a chance we could, if we think they're not a believer and we haven't had a chance to really share the Lord with them, that may sound a little bit crass to consider resuscitating a person to evangelize them and then not resuscitate them the next time, but anybody could pull out a case. Of Dr. Joe Bancroft here in town has a case that he discusses in this context where he defibrillated and resuscitated a person a dozen times in one night for VFib, and that person then went on to live a very full life for years afterward. And it's pretty hard though to make generalizations from cases like that. Okay, go ahead.
60-year-old gentleman has post-cardiopulmonary arrest, now with an acute brain injury, has pulmonary dysfunction, now going into renal failure, GI lesion.
Mm-hmm.
Can't get in touch with the family to discuss the.
Okay. A patient with multiple organ system failure, anoxic encephalopathy, renal failure, and also can't get in touch with the family, which is certainly important. I think in light of the fact that the question relates to do not resuscitate, and that conjures up actual cardiopulmonary resuscitation, simply the fact that resuscitating him if his heart, if he does develop lethal arrhythmia, especially VFib, would be unlikely to improve his overall prognosis. It may not be a real difficult decision unless there are other factors that you haven't mentioned there. We know we have excellent legal precedent for issuing a do not resuscitate order. I think even if we can't get in touch with the family, then we simply do the other procedures and have someone else in the care of the patient or unrelated to the care of the patient agree to it or whatever.
I've seen people like that wake up too.
You sure have.
Injury was pretty recent.
Yeah, that's sure. If the anoxic injury is recent, then that may make you want to be more aggressive. The more organ systems, on the other hand, that have already failed and probably irreversibly failed, then the more you might be justified in doing a DNR order. If that's simply a decision, not again, that's just a drawing of a line. At this point, you probably wouldn't do a renal transplant on that patient with anoxic encephalopathy. And so you're just going down the line, and CPR comes in there somewhere. Below CPR is hydration, antibiotics, ventilatory support. And you're just, again, asking about where you're going to draw the line, and is it above or below actual CPR?
These people, they fall upon dignity in all respects. At some point, I think you do them a favor. There's just so much more peaceful once you do turn off the machine. It's so sad. It tears up the family. You can see the family go through this week in and week out. It seems more loving and just to me a lot of times to turn off or to let them die, not to keep them from cancer.
Sure. That, I think it's very, it's not only possible but common that situations occur where it is, where that is true. Yeah. Okay.
This is more of a legal question. Where do we stand legally in that respect?
There's, let's see. Now, I don't know whether we ought to get that in that now. We're supposed to break at this point, but there's certainly a strong legal precedent for discontinuing all kinds of medical support. Legally, you're pretty well covered, I think, as long as you've covered the other bases and that you've documented everything in the chart regarding the prognosis and the failure of the patient to respond to therapy and so on and on. There, at least, and that also is a question that relates to the particular state that you're in. In Alabama, I know of no precedent for court cases that have come up related to one person wanting to stop therapy and another not. Those tend to be coastal cases, by and large. New Jersey, Massachusetts, Florida, and California. So I think it's fairly clear, at least in Alabama. Okay, thank you for participating in...